This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 18th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 254 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll meet one of the only journalists to have crossed into the Balochistan region of Pakistan, Willem Marks.
Plus, we'll trace the history of perhaps the most important human invention, paper.
Also ahead...
I don't think I sound like a woman. I think I sound like a very small man. You know, like this high...
I'm used to hearing my voice now. When I would first hear it, I, quite frankly, would be appalled.
Is there such a thing as a gay voice? We'll put the question to David Thorpe, who is finishing that documentary on that very subject.
Oh, that plus some tunes too, right here on the Monocle Weekly, right here on Monocle 24. Good afternoon, Tom.
Good afternoon, Rob. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you very much indeed. How does this Sunday find you?
I would go so far as to say I'm in rude health.
I like that. I like rude health, of rude health.
It's a good place to be.
It's sort of rude, presumably that means that's referring to the ruddiness of your cheek.
I think so. I feel
plump of fetlock, firm
ruddy.
Of thigh.
And I feel physically close to my best.
Well, you look like some sort of god.
Oh, I try my best. Yeah. I had a sports injury recently, so I've overcome that now.
What did you have? Was it a hamstring, metatarsal?
It was a hamstring. Playing football. Full authentic sporting injury.
I like it when people sort of get sporting injuries, but from getting up off the sofa or changing the channel or walking the dog or something.
One of my personal favourites, I can't remember who it was, might have been a former Premier League goalkeeper of some renown, damaged, out for several weeks, opening a jar of salad cream.
Is this David James?
I think it was David James.
Yeah, I seem to remember this.
The banality of injury.
The banality of injury. Also, I just love the window that it gives you onto his.
Yeah, a little bit of insight there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it's not really, you know, come on, you could do a bit better than that, David.
Guy was eating a salad. I mean, that's good in itself.
We don't need to do any jokes about the former Arsenal goalkeeper, David Seaman, and...
Let's move away from
Let's keep it clean. It's a family show. I, from my point of view, working across both the radio station and the magazine, this week's been a kind of nice week of commissioning stuff. It's been quite chilled out. I've been in the office all week. It's kind of felt...
It's been nice to have you around, Rob, I have to be honest.
It's been kind of like a nice... The Sun's put its hat on in London. Next week, it's our German extravaganza. Are we both going on that show?
I fear that I'm not.
Oh, sorry.
But thanks for bringing that up.
I'll bring you back a sausage.
That's lovely. Bit of wurst.
My worst is the very best.
I can't concentrate now. And it's a few cities you're striking off on your...
I'm hitting... where am I going? I'm going to Munich. Tick.
I absolutely love Munich.
Munich's really great. And then I'm getting the train, an early morning train to Frankfurt, where I'm presenting a radio show called Briefing
on this
network.
Special show here next week.
It'll be coming live at midday, 1300 in Frankfurt. And then we're going to Hamburg. I've not been to Hamburg before.
I have also not visited Hamburg.
So we go to Hamburg.
Very, very fine.
And then a bit of Berlin for the weekend. You can't stay further than that.
That's
boom.
That's a quadruple.
I wish I could count. I mean, who? I don't know. I'm trying to think of someone famous that could count it on the fingers of one hand. A Japanese gangster.
Exactly. I see what you've done there.
Yeah.
That's good.
Okay. What are we going to do?
Because the radio is the best medium for what is essentially a side gag.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's going to be fun. You're going to have I hope you get a warm willkommen locations.
I'm sure I will. Yeah, I'll be all right. I'm going to do a little bit of language lab for the rest of this weekend.
Very good.
I
can speak a little German, so I could help you along the way.
I think maybe we'll do that while we're doing the things that we play in between the interviews, jingles, some of the promos for other shows.
We'll talk purely in German.
When microphones are off.
Exactly, before we hear from our first guest, who is going to be looking, indeed, at... the next week or Woche ahead.
It could only be one man, the man with the most German name imaginable, Daniel Jacopelli. Daniel Jacopelli, welcome to the show. With some papers to rustle for the News Look ahead this week.
Well, you know what? Rob, we're going to start with a bit of it's like a spy case, not really a spy case at all, but it seems like a spy case. So I printed what looks like a dossier to you.
Okay.
And by dossier, it's a Wikipedia printout.
It looks very comprehensive, Danny.
Essentially, what is happening on Monday, guys, Ratko Mladic, his defense starts on Monday. So the prosecution ended on the 26th of February, and now it's every lawyer's worst nightmare. It's the defending a war criminal, essentially. How do you do it? And we're going to find out on Monday. So he's accused of, obviously, genocide, which is probably the hardest thing you can defend against, I would assume.
What, Tom, would you think is a good way to defend against an allegedly genocidal warlord?
I imagine you need to go for some kind of pretty significant historical explanation for why, basically, your client wasn't there, essentially.
Yeah, and have they done... Yeah, you need an alibi.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he was...
Might be pretty hard. He commanded the Bosnian Serb Army main staff, and it's pretty certain that he did what he's accused of. But we'll find out on Monday.
What have they... Because for Milosevic, I think at one point, and maybe Radovan Karadzic, they pleaded insanity, didn't they? Have they done this yet? It's always the Trump card,
isn't it? He was certainly unwell, as if I recall. Didn't he plead at one point that he was too ill to stand trial?
Melodic.
At some stage.
At one stage. I mean, he was at large for almost 16 years, arrested in May of... 2011, and he was kind of frail when they arrested him initially. I think he had a problem speaking, actually, when they first arrested him. But I'm not sure if he's pleading insane. I don't think he is, though.
One interesting detail in the sheaf of papers you gave us, Danny, which is that about 4 years ago, his family, because he was at large, his family filed a request to declare him dead, because then his wife would have been able to collect his pension and sell his property. So they said, oh, well, he's never coming back. How about this? And he was living, like, in the basement.
It sounds like a Daily Mail article.
I hadn't thought that one through.
No. Let's move on. On Wednesday...
sort of funny on General Ratko Mladic, not to be confused with the English stand-up comedian Stuart Lee.
Moving on. On Wednesday, Rob, you might find this interesting. It's the fifth Prix Pictet.
Always good.
Always good. I know you always follow that. Yeah. The focus this year is on consumption. I've just given you a few...
Not in the sort
the
of...
The Victorian illness.
I was going to say, yes. Sort of lots of ladies with doily handkerchiefs fainting.
No, definitely not on that. I've given you a few examples of what we might see. Some of the shortlisted artists. The Financial Times actually has a bit of that. As I said, it's the fifth cycle of the prize. For those who don't know, it's an award for photography and sustainability. So it's at the V&A here, the Victoria and Albert Museum.
Some great images here. I love this consumerism picture. is this a sort of image of various kind of Chinese packaging? Presented in this very sort of intense way. It looks almost like a... I don't know how to describe that. Sort of lurid colours, but they're all individual.
It's wonderful, isn't it? It's a collection of... It's called My Things, isn't it? It's a collection of stuff shot from the top, but it looks almost like a... looks like a flyover. It could be a cityscape. It could be a collage. It looks amazing.
It's got
kind of... It reminds me slightly of the work of Peter Blake in the 60s. That sort of collage kind of look to it.
Lovely. And all of these will be exhibited from the 22nd through mid-June, actually, at the V&A, where you can see them.
And it's always a good show. This, you know, it's one of those things. It's sponsored by and named after this bank, it's good. I think they kind of put their heart and soul into this sort of thing, and they get some amazing entrants. And I think the prize is pretty mega. It's quite a big prize that these people win for it. The competition is always incredibly strong. And it's kind of gone from strength to strength. The V&A this year, this is kind of like a big deal for them as well, I'd have thought.
Let's move on. Also next week, it's this. A branding, essentially, announcement. It's the brand's top 100 most valuable global brands ranking. It basically ranks the most valuable brands in the world according to their dollar value.
What are we looking at the top, the sort of Apples of this world?
Yeah, exactly. They keep it hush-hush until it's announced. It's announced on the 21st. But, you know, being fans of brands, we might want to keep an eye out on that.
When is this announced, Danny?
It's announced on the 21st. Which is Wednesday.
That's Wednesday. That's quite a good one, that. I think that'd be quite interesting.
It is interesting. I like in your press release that you've shown us here, Danny. Not your press release, but from this event.
I've written it myself.
They've got some key lessons about how to ensure that you feature highly on said list of brands.
Learn to live locally is the final one.
I think that's quite interesting. Make your own connection. I quite literally don't know what that means.
I really don't know what any of them mean.
No. The first one, though, Rob, is identify a human truth. So take it away.
Okay. Well, this is a song I wrote when I was on the road. It goes a little bit like this.
Next week, also at the end of the week, is the Monaco Grand Prix.
The Monocle Grand Prix.
The Monocle.
Bloody hell, I was
the Monocle
say.
Grand Prix.
It's come around early, isn't it?
Yeah,
I always think that's kind
weekend.
Of like a midsummer event, the race in Monte Carlo.
It kind of is midsummer now, Rob. I know London is doing its best to
hide its light under a bushel.
Yeah, but yeah. Monaco Grand Prix, one of the great sporting events in my view.
It's a marquee event.
It is a marquee event.
Have you been to a Grand Prix before?
I've not been to the Monaco Grand Prix, no.
I've been to the Montreal one.
Oh.
It's quite fun.
It's
Montreal turns into a big party city during the Grand
Prix. I think Montreal's quite a good race, actually. It's quite a good track they've got. Monte Carlo, presumably one of the best spectator ones, because they obviously go pretty slowly. You get to see a lot of the stuff. That's pretty cool.
And just I think the city circuit is such a wonderful idea. I guess for the uninitiated, the cars do actually race around the very streets of Monaco. And if you drive around Monaco, you occasionally will find a pavement that has that red and white hatching. And
yeah,
you can
yeah,
sort
yeah.
of execute the turn yourself.
It's pretty cool.
It's pretty exciting.
Done that in the hire car, Fiat Panda?
Fiat 500.
One of
the new ones.
Nice.
I felt pretty kind of...
You felt like Graham Hill.
What have you done, Tom?
I've driven parts of the Monaco course.
In a Prius?
In a Fiat 500.
Okay.
Great car. Yeah. Great. So it was a great deal of fun.
I don't think there's anything to laugh at there. I'd do the same thing.
Through the tunnel. That's the most fun thing.
Mm.
Did you make sort of car noises
a
bit?
I absolutely did do that. Put the windows down
breath.
And went, meow. I think they actually have a sign that says, stop doing that.
Yeah.
In there because everyone tries
no
it.
No miming being in a Formula
exactly.
One car.
People taking selfies.
But that's a great event,
through.
Danny. You should attend that one. I think that might be even more exciting.
I should maybe
Montreal.
Go for the entrepreneur, shouldn't I?
Well, I think you should do it on your own.
I think I should go for the entrepreneur.
You can both travel on your own dime if you want.
I can't end a look ahead without talking about the Egyptian election. Campaigning essentially ends at the end of next week, and the first round of voting takes place the 26th to the 27th. So, of course, we'll be following that on Monocle 24.
And let's hope it delivers a slightly more sustainable outcome than last time, perhaps.
Let's hope so.
I think unlikely, though, frankly.
I think you're correct, Tom.
But let's not. I don't want to be a naysayer.
Wonder how we can meld all those news stories together into one amazing race. I think we'll have to give ourselves some time off. Maybe at the end of the show, Tom, we'll have thought of a way.
I'll try and come up with something.
A beautiful denouement,
as well.
A tying up of strings at the end. We'll wonder, you know, exactly who finished first, second, and third on that podium at the Grand Prix.
What a podium that'll be.
I wouldn't mind guessing there's no medal for General Ratko Mladic.
No.
I was going to say.
Definitely not.
Danny Jacopelli, thank you very much indeed for your news look ahead. What's happening next on the show?
I think we'll be back with... You know what we're going to be doing, Rob, is taking a glimpse into one of the world's most dangerous regions.
And you are back with the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Balochistan is Pakistan's largest region, yet the smallest in terms of population. Bordering Afghanistan and Iran, it's at a strategic crossroads geographically, but also hugely important because of its gas, oil, gold, and uranium reserves. The area has, until now, remained almost completely inaccessible to foreigners.
Journalist Willem Marx, though, managed to get to the region along with French photographer Marc Vatrelot. They have come back with a story in words and images that grant us rare insights into a beautiful land, which also happens to be one of the most dangerous places in the world. After the publication of the book, Balochistan at a Crossroads, Marx has been refused access to Pakistan, and he joins us now to discuss the book in a little more detail. Willem, thanks for joining us here on the Weekly. Tell me about... Was that an unforeseen response from Pakistan, or did you sort of fear that something like that?
Well, I mean, it's not unexpected. There are quite a few journalists over the last few years who've been denied access there, or indeed kicked out of the country. And I was meant to be going to Lahore in February to talk at the literary festival about the book, and was slightly saddened to find out that my visa had been rejected, and therefore I wouldn't be going. This was going to be a good opportunity to talk about the subject that's really very taboo in Pakistan, especially in the Pakistani media. Balochistan is, as you say, the largest part of the country. It is a province, but really what's happening there is not publicized a great deal domestically. It's an area of the country that's very militarized. The military occupies much of the territory and tries to control the narrative. And that's one of the reasons it's very difficult as a journalist to get in there, to get a visa, permit to travel there. And then if you do write or report for television, as I did, on the area and the civil conflict that's kind of racking the province, you're not often welcome back. That seems to be the problem.
And what was your initial... How did you end up there originally? And then how did you go with the idea of... Well, it sounds like you were obviously a journalist there, but how did that kind of come? Did you kind of venture north and east and wherever to end up there? And it was one of those things. Or did you want to go for it because it was kind of... It was persona non grata as far as Pakistan was concerned?
A little bit of that. I mean, I was starting a new job as a TV reporter at a US station, a US program. And my new boss said, you know, what kind of stories would you like to do? And I said, I've heard about this area called Baluchistan. It sounds really interesting. And at the time...
And he had a chat with the insurers and he said,
yeah, exactly.
Under no circumstances should you go.
Looked up the kidnap and ransom details, yeah. No, I went to go and meet this young man who at the time was living on the Iran-Pakistan border. And in the Washington, D.C. rumor mill, he was being named as the mastermind of these attacks on the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. And he was a Sunni belonging to this Baluch ethnicity that spans both Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And he was railing against the Iranian Revolution, both for its attitude towards ethnic minorities like the Baluch, but also as a Sunni, he felt that he was his religious rights were being kind of denied by the Shia majority there. And he'd been attacking these Revolutionary Guard stations and border police and kidnapping some of them, beheading some of them. And it was frankly becoming a bit of an embarrassment for the Iranian authorities in that region, Baluchistan. And people in Washington were saying, he must be getting outside help. He must be getting funding from the CIA. And this was in 2007 when a lot of the rhetoric from people like Dick Cheney was very sort of aggressive towards Iran. And there were all these ideas that maybe the CIA was funding these sort of peripheral groups. And my boss loved this idea and said, yeah, let's go and try and meet him. And no one ever had. He was kind of this shadowy figure. And once I managed to persuade the Pakistani authorities, the Iranians were very unwilling for me to go to that region. The Pakistanis, I told them I wanted to look at economic and political changes, a very broad, vague term for what I wanted to do there. They gave me a visa, and I managed to set up an interview with him on the border through people in the UAE. There's a big diaspora of these Baluch all over the world, but a lot of them in the Gulf. And went and interviewed this guy, and he was very young like me. We were both about 24 years old. He was in charge of several hundred fighters at that point who had been embarrassing the Iranian military. And he was a very charismatic sociopath, I would say, and a great character for a television report. It was a 25-minute sort of short film we ended up doing. And while I was there, this was kind of a small group of Iranian Baluch. I became fascinated by what was happening in much of the rest of the Pakistani province of Baluchistan, where over the previous 2 years, this insurgency had been growing that was far more secular than this other man's organization. And they were really talking about wanting autonomy for their province. They felt that with all this natural wealth in the ground, they weren't getting a fair share from Pakistan's central government. And so they had taken up arms, several hundred of them, and they were living in these very isolated mountain camps, and they were attacking Pakistani military infrastructure, which is, you know, part of one of the largest standing armies in the world, and at the time and still to this day is very heavily subsidized by the American taxpayer. And so I was absolutely astounded to see that this American-funded weaponry was being used against Pakistani citizens who had nothing in common with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, which were kind of ostensibly America's enemies in that region. And not only were there attacks on the insurgent groups and the guerrillas fighting in the mountains, that there was also this new form of counterinsurgency tactic employed by the Pakistani military, which involved picking up political dissidents, often young students, from their homes, from checkpoints on the road, from a restaurant, and disappearing these people. And we've seen this in countries all over the world over the last several hundred years, this kind of counterinsurgency. But what was specifically brutal about it in the Baluchistan context was these guys would not be acknowledged as having been taken by Pakistan's security services. And then they would often be tortured. And again, that's nothing too surprising. But there was a huge signal sent every time one of these guys was killed. Their body was found often hundreds of miles from where they'd been taken on public display on a roadside, really as a warning to other political would-be dissidents, don't mess with us, we're the Pakistani military, and we don't broach any criticism.
To focus on the book itself as an artifact, it's a beautiful piece of work, and especially Mark's pictures, your pal, the photographer, who obviously went and worked with. Having looked at some of the pictures in the book, they sort of bear out what you're saying, but there is also kind of there is a great nobility to some of the faces that you photograph and the landscape that you shoot or that you write about and Mark shoots. It's a bit of a dichotomy there, isn't there, between some of the kind of barbarism and some of the beauty. I suppose that was the point, that was one of the things that attracted you. Are you kind of happy? Do you feel that the book as an end result is precisely what you experienced there, the toughness and some of the rough stuff and some of the beauty?
I think so. I mean, it really is a very barren but beautiful landscape, and you can see that in Mark's images. And we chose to work in black and white because we thought it was such an elegant way to show this landscape. A lot of that light there is incredibly bright, and you do worry about these photos being blown out if they're in color. Mm. But also, I think it was giving a sort of historical context to the region that maybe people didn't necessarily appreciate. When you see photographs in black and white, you can imagine that this is something that hasn't changed a great deal in some ways. And I'm no Orientalist, but there is a certain sort of romance you almost touched upon there.
There's a sort of past tense sometimes to black and white photography. Did you have that conversation with Mark?
It is, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And certainly some of the more remote regions, it's still a very, very tribal part of the world. And some of the tribal chieftains there, they're not necessarily very nice individuals, but they do command a very sort of loyal allegiance from their tribal members. And to see some of these images, you could go back 100 years and it wouldn't have been a great deal different. And we thought that was something that people would understand a bit better, I think, if it was in black and white. And as a product, we've been very happy with it. Yeah, definitely.
Well, it's a beautiful piece of work, for sure. But it's an interesting thing. There is always that moment in collaboration between writers and photographers. But, you know, it's a nice way to work because notices things that the other doesn't.
Absolutely.
About the other person's line of business, if you know what I mean. And that's how these things work. But it's interesting to know that you had those
conversations. We spent a lot more time than I probably would have anticipated in terms of layout design and figuring out which photographs would go where and which photographs to use and how we'd work that in with the text. So that was an interesting challenge.
What about the sort of wider narrative then? You know, the book is called Balochistan at a Crossroads. Is this a country you describe that history, the complexity of the relationships between the people and the geography, the sort of terrible beauty that you're both talking about? Where does it go next at this crossroads? Mm. What is ahead? Is it a place that's sort of out of step with the world?
In some senses, yes, but in another sense, the people there, the Baluch that I met, are like people anywhere. In a sense, they want the right of self-determination. And many of them inside Pakistan feel that since partition, they haven't really had a chance to express themselves as a nation, as a culture, that their language is very much discouraged from being taught in the schools, for instance. And ever since 1947, many of them at least, have said, we want some degree of autonomy, and that's really hardened because of the brutality of the counterinsurgency against specifically these political dissidents, political movements. Many of them now say, we want an independent Balochistan, and that's become a real rallying cry for people there. And in terms of it being a crossroads, at a crossroads, deciding where to go next, it's going to be very difficult for them as part of Pakistan to try and separate themselves. And we've seen it with Bangladesh in the 70s.
Is it a secular movement? I just wonder, you mentioned already there's this bit of a contradiction between some of these different elements and who is representing who and who is not. Is there a secular campaign for that self-determination?
Very much so.
And can they rival the sort of, you know, even the rhetoric of some of the more, you know, religiously driven groups, do you think?
That's a good question. I think in terms of the savagery of the violence, I think the nationalist movement there has lost a lot of the moral high ground they may have had several years ago, where they were just targeting military and government infrastructure and personnel, and now they are going after civilians, at least factions of that movement are, and that really makes them no better or no worse than, say, the Taliban, and Pakistani Taliban in particular, who've often targeted civilians. I think the concern of many of the more mainstream members there is that if they do get tarred with that brush, it's going to be very difficult for them to win outside support, either from international organizations or from Western powers that might try and step in. And I think they'll lose a lot of the sympathy that they might otherwise win from these very brutal counterinsurgency tactics from the military if they themselves are seen to be responding that brutally. But they do tend to reject the idea of people like the Taliban. They see themselves as very different to them.
Well, Willem, thank you very much for joining us. That was Willem Marks, author of Balochistan at a Crossroads, and that book is out now. And we should add, all the proceeds of the book go to polio eradication in Pakistan. All right, let's have some music now. Tom, this is new from Brian Eno and Carl Hyde from Underworld. This is from a record called Someday Well, which came out last week. This is Daddy's Car.
That was Daddy's Car, the first single out of Carl Hyde and Brian Eno's collaborative album, Someday World.
It is perhaps the most important human invention aside from fire. It can last for hundreds of years, but it can also vanish in a split second. Children play with it, but it can be prized and expensive as the interface of the world's greatest paintings. Without it, we wouldn't have books, letters, or even bus tickets. Hell, we wouldn't even be able to discuss our next guest's work because it wouldn't have been able to go to print.
That's right. We're talking about paper, that genius Chinese invention that's very much become an essential part of our everyday lives. So how and when did paper take over the world? That's the story that Alex Munro, an expert in contemporary China, sets out to tell in The Paper Trail, an Unexpected History of the World's Greatest Invention. Alex joins us now here in the studio to tell us how we came to hold this book and the paper therein in our hands. Alex, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start by your title. You said it's an unexpected history. Was this a story for you as you conducted your research and looked into the history of the unexpected? Or did you sort of go into it with certain assumptions that were actually borne out by your research? How many unexpected twists were there on the way?
I think it was unexpected from the start, because originally my interest was piqued by reading about the Mongols, and the Mongols had gone conquering across Asia and into Europe in the 13th century. And when they'd got to what is now northwestern China, they'd met the Uyghur people, and that they'd noticed that the Uyghurs used writing very effectively, but they were an illiterate people. The Mongols were actually an amalgam of tribes by that point. But none of them used writing. And they realized it was useful. And so they asked the Uyghur scribes to pen them a script. And I sort of got interested in this idea that somehow the conquerors had actually been changed by the conquest, not the other way around. And that got me interested in writing. And then inevitably, paper sort of reared its head at that point.
But was it useful before writing? Because that's presumably the thing. I mean, writing is obviously what it's been best for.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was obviously something that it sounds like it was an accidental discovery, and people were like, well, I was just lying in my bed one night, and I accidentally drew a drawing on my headboard. Like, how did people start writing on it? Because clearly that wasn't presumably what it was first for.
I think that is the key question that we can't answer, because we know that there was paper.
Should we attempt to answer it now around this very table?
Should we just have a go?
This Sunday, let's do it.
So we know there was paper in the 2nd century BC. There is one example of paper from the 3rd century BC wrapped around a wooden model, but the model was bought by a collector and it's never been independently verified. So that may be the oldest. But the point is, it wasn't being used for writing at that point. And it certainly didn't become the mainstream surface for writing in China until, you know, really the 3rd century. So there's a long period during which paper is used for kites, it's used for balloons, it's used for military signalling. In one story from the official histories of China, it's used for execution. An enormous kite which a prisoner is attached to.
Oh, wow.
Supposedly executed.
That's the mother of all paper cuts.
But my point is that it was used for all these other things, and some, you know, apocryphal stories, real stories, and so on. But we don't really have much of an idea how they came up with it. I mean, Dard Hunter, who's this great paper historian from the US, reckons it could have been a washerwoman, because they originally made paper out of linen, leftover linen rags. So it could easily have been a washerwoman who, you know, cleaning her linen, effectively left some out to dry when it was shredded, and it formed a kind of a sheet, a pretty uneven sheet. And the point is, I mean, this is the point of sort of chapter three of the book, is that writing was enormous in China before paper, but in a very limited segment of the population, the kind of bureaucratic, scholarly elite. So writing is already big.
So this was like carved or
this was on
into
bamboo. Okay. It was painted with a brush, but it was on bamboo, it was on wood, it was on silk. So writing's already very big. So all it needed was someone to think, oh, let's try it on this surface, paper, why not? They're already practicing their writing on stone. They're doing it on all sorts of surfaces. So why not try it on this new substance? And even then, it took a long time to catch on.
And I know, having read a little biog of you, you're a China scholar, but I wonder where the genesis of the book came from. Did it come from the love of Chinese literature and history and finding the history of paper bound up in that? Or was it because you're a paper purist, because actually you kind of feel that this is still the form that all media aspires to, is paper?
No, it didn't come about because of the media. It came about because of China. So I got very interested in China at an early stage.
It's interesting Rob said that thing about paper purists, and I wonder, all the talk now is about digital and the threat that, you know, sort of offers to traditional media, by which people tend to mean paper and print. Do you find that you've got an additional loyalty, if you like, to paper through having researched the book almost?
I do feel loyal to it, but I think what I disagree with is an argument you often hear in favour of paper is that it can be more elegant, can be more beautiful. We prefer to have something that looks attractive. And obviously, I agree that it can look very attractive. But actually, the personality of paper through its history has not been something very beautiful, something very ornate, even though you can find examples in history, particularly in Japan, where paper was used to extraordinary dramatic and artistic effect. Actually, the power of paper has been how pedestrian it's been, how ordinary it's been, how cheap it's been, how universal it's been, how the ingredients are everywhere, how it enables knowledge to be accessed by people who could never have accessed it otherwise. So actually, the power of paper lies in how ordinary it is, how available it is. I do love paper, but I think there was something that it achieved. And I think once you focus on the elegance of it, then you are looking at a different substance.
You're obviously alluding to the boom in free thinking that paper enabled. In, I guess, as it especially, I might be wrong here, but especially as it headed west from China after it sort of after it was first used as a writing, as something to write on. Tell us about very briefly about that, about how that presumably marauded like fire westward, and with Gutenberg in the 1400s and all the rest of it. This presumably was something of a golden age for this medium.
Yes, that was. I mean, one of the first moments of sort of breakthrough in terms of ideas, I think, comes in China. So paper's born into a culture that is very Confucian, that holds up the Confucian classics as the guide to life, the guide to government, the guide to the social order. And they're all written out on bamboo, and bamboo is associated with the content of the books themselves. So it's respected.
There's an elegant. We talk about the elegance of paper, yes. Maybe an encyclopedia or something like that. We think it can only be on paper.
Yeah.
The thing happened before, but bamboo.
It was on bamboo, and that was for an elite, and an elite that governed society. And so in that sense, knowledge and books were the possession of a very small cabal at the top. I think what the first popular movement you get that's quite radical is the arrival of Buddhism in China. No one knows exactly when it arrived, but it begins to really take off in the 2nd, 3rd centuries AD. And it arrives on paper, and that's a key change. I don't think Confucians would have made the switch to paper automatically themselves. They associated their writings with bamboo. But this foreign religion, it chose much more colloquial words and word orders. It wrote in a much more accessible style.
There's a sort of King James Bible aspect to this.
Exactly. Yeah. So people can read it, people can access it. And in fact, you didn't even need to be able to read it. People would buy Buddhist charms written out on paper. So suddenly there's a much broader circulation of paper writings with this entirely foreign religion. So that immediately dilutes the kind of, you know, the unitary philosophical kind of personality. Yeah. Or unitary political personality of China in a way. So I think that's an enormous breakthrough. But you mentioned Gutenberg. My argument with Gutenberg is that we do obviously look back to printing as this enormous breakthrough, movable type printing. Half of the breakthrough was movable type printing. I completely agree for alphabets. It doesn't work for, say, Chinese. But the other half was paper, because he could never have had that impact. He could never have produced those kind of rapid print texts on parchment or on vellum. He could only have done it on paper. It's smooth enough. It's easy to do. So I think it was a paper movement. But absolutely, I agree. It created a whole new series of centres of production. So monastic copying had been enormous in medieval Europe. There had been somewhat of a shift towards the universities. But the development of printing, suddenly, with a significant amount of money, admittedly, but several merchants are beginning to set up their own printers, suddenly have new centres producing books. They're beginning to think in terms of a market. So all of that is very radical in the way that books are produced and in the purposes for which they're produced. And I think you see that sort of the logic being played out in the subjects that are addressed. And I think you see that being played out as well in the sort of innovation in thinking that you get in the Renaissance and in the Reformation. And the other thing is a look backwards. They step back and they say, we want to go back to original texts in the Greek and in the Latin and the Hebrew. We want to retranslate them. We want to make them accessible. We want people to be able to understand them. We think these are important. So I think those two are going on at the same time, and paper enables both of them.
Without wishing to be glib about the title, I just wondered briefly whether the sort of the paper trail comes to an end. I already alluded to that idea of, you know, the triumph of the digital, and we talked about the sort of democratizing power, the power of paper in spreading ideas and giving power to readers on a massive level. Now people say, well, that's all available digitally, you no longer need the paper. Does the story of paper then, is it winding down, do you think?
I think it has changed enormously. I mean, I don't think we're in the paper age anymore. So, you know, I would define the paper age as when paper is the unrivaled medium of written and printed communication. That's clearly not the case anymore. So we've left that. However, I don't think at the same time that the paper trail has ended, and I don't think it is at any risk of ending anytime soon. I do sort of end the trail in New Zealand, strangely enough, with an encounter between the British and the Maori and the Treaty of Waitangi in 1840, this attempt to find a political solution so trade can continue, but it's written out on paper. And there's an assumption there that because something's written down, it must be better and it must be lasting. Whereas obviously in an oral culture, that kind of logic doesn't apply. So there are problems with the assumptions that sometimes go along with paper. But I think now we're still living very much in an age where we share, you know, the digital and the paper. Both media are really very important. And while a lot of practical areas will never move back to paper, there is no point, I don't think, printing an encyclopedia on paper. There is no point using a paper map nearly as much as there was 10 years ago. Nevertheless, there are areas in which ownership makes an enormous difference to how you value something. And, you know, you don't own a book on Kindle. You only buy the license to access it. Whereas I think if you actually own a book, it lasts, it's in your hands. There's a different experience of reading, a physical experience of reading. I think it has more of an impact on you. And I think it probably makes the book less important by the fact that it can disappear in one click of a mouse.
And you can't make an impromptu bar at a party out of a stack of virtual books and a door, can you?
There are many practical uses.
I know you had lunch with your publishers, Penguin, this book's published by Alan Lane. They presumably were quite interested to kind of hear about your epilogue, about what happens next to paper, a company like that that's had such an august history based on the very medium about which you're writing. What a brilliant idea. We'll publish it for you. Tell us about the future.
They have an unusual history in this. First of all, because of course the whole point was that they wanted to publish great works, make them cheap and accessible.
Yeah.
So democratisation, very important. They had a machine, I think it was on Charing Cross Road back in the 30s. You can find it on Google Images, probably more recent actually, called a Penguincubator, which was like a machine that you could buy your novel in. So there was this idea that, you know, paper was that accessible that you could just walk down the street, put a coin in a slot and get your novel. And I think that will still remain. I know there are a lot of bookshops closing, but I think that for the novel in particular, there's a real power about it remaining on paper. And I think on Amazon, you've seen a slight tailing off in terms of the percentile growth, if you like, of Kindle book sales versus paper book sales. So that may tell a story in itself.
Well, Alex, you're brilliant at talking about it. That was Alex Monro, author of The Paper Trail, An Unexpected History of the World's Greatest Invention. And it's out now, published by Alan Lane. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we ask if there really is such a thing as a gay voice. Stay tuned.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards. Now, is there such a thing as a gay voice? Do people really sound gay? Well, that's the theory that first-time filmmaker David Thorpe has set out to explore in his new documentary, Do I Sound Gay?
I don't think I sound like a woman. I think I sound like a very small man. You know, like this high.
I'm used to hearing my voice now. When I would first hear it, I, quite frankly, would be appalled.
Now, Thorpe has logged 165 interviews in four countries targeting speech therapists, linguistic professors, gay men, straight men, and celebrities such as Tim Gunn, David Sedaris, and George Takei, who discuss anxieties with their own gay voices. He's now in the post-production stage of his film and has gained international attention after launching a crowdfunding campaign on Kickstarter. And I'm delighted to say we're going to be able to hear David's voice right now as he joins us from our New York bureau. David, thanks very much for joining us. The idea behind this film, it seems such fun. You're watching the clips, the trailer. There's an incredible amount of passion with which people discuss this topic. Is it a story, do you feel, that's basically never really been told? Is that why you wanted to be the man to tell it?
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for having me. And yes, that is exactly why I've spent 3 years fighting to finish Do I Sound Gay? And we have this ambitious Kickstarter campaign because it hasn't been dealt with in a comprehensive way. And I think now is the time. And we have an amazing cast of people in the film who agree.
And David, it is, we were saying, it's an amusing thing. There's obviously some very amusing moments in the movie and in the trailer, which people presumably can click on and watch now online. There's the point of this, actually, is that there's a serious side to this, because a lot of gay men feel very conscious and self-conscious about the way they sound. Was that your experience? Was that one of the reasons that you put the film together in the first place?
Absolutely. And you keyed right into why it's such a powerful topic and a powerful symbol, because there is something wonderful and celebratory about the gay voice and sounding gay. But it also is one of the ways in which kids are targeted and bullied, and adults carry that into their lives from that point forward. So I was terrified of sounding, appearing, looking, acting, dressing gay when I was a kid. And as I came out and became more comfortable with myself, I found that in some respects, my gay voice, my fairly stereotypical gay voice, was a potential liability.
It's interesting you talk about the difficulty, the self-consciousness that a lot of people feel about the way they sound. And I was wondering whether in your course of interviewing all of these different contributors that you found a lot of people who basically hadn't encountered that problem and had always been very at ease with how they sounded and the view that they thought other people took of them because of their voice.
Well, before undertaking this project, I, of course, did a lot of research, and I went out on the street and talked to gay men I did not know on the street to find out, you know, whether this was something that they also thought about. And I did meet some men who said, I love my voice, I've never been self-conscious about it, and if someone thinks I sound gay, great. Every gay man I met was keenly aware of the role that his voice plays in how he's perceived. So while some men were very comfortable with sounding gay, they were also very in tune with how it might affect people's perception of them. And a lot of what the movie is about is how do you kind of find the strength to be one of those people who is who he is and doesn't care how he's perceived.
And did anybody, while you were doing this, gay guys or straight guys, kind of take offense? Did they kind of say, well, this is who I am, how dare you question it? Do you know what I mean? Were there some awkward moments in putting this film together where people perhaps felt that you were presuming something about them that wasn't true, or that you'd kind of found a hotline to their sexuality just through their voice, and there was a presumptive element to that, David? Or was it kind of plain sailing? You knew with whom you were dealing at all times, whether they were gay guys or straight guys. How did it work out?
I definitely had a few bumpy moments when I was interviewing people. For example, there was a straight guy who was just absolutely taken aback that I thought he sounded gay. And we spent quite a bit of time on the street having a discussion about why I might have perceived him to be gay.
So he kind of took offense at that.
Well, you know, I think he was a little shocked by it. But I think the whole point of this endeavor is that there's nothing wrong with being gay, so there's nothing wrong with sounding gay. So no one should take offense if I or anyone else says, you know, Tom sounds gay, because there's nothing wrong with being gay. And I called the movie Do I Sound Gay to be provocative, but also to take back the idea that there's nothing wrong with sounding gay. Did that make sense?
Absolutely, David. Yeah. I just wondered, in terms of that sound there, did you find, is there a sort of an international, you know, received pronunciation? Did there something that maybe even crosses borders? Is there basically a gay accent, if you will, that does even go across language barriers?
Well, sounding gay, without a doubt, goes across all languages. I don't want to give it all away. I really want your folks to pitch in on our Kickstarter.
There's no plot spoilers here, David, don't worry.
Yes. Okay. So I've got to keep some of the juicy details to myself for now, but we do go into why there are people who sound gay in every language, and it has to do with gender and where your vocal choices land you on a gender spectrum, to get very academic for a moment.
But this is to do with, I mean, this is addressed, not to spoil any plot here, but this is sort of addressed in the trailer, isn't it? The fact that one might have been close to one's mother, or it's about female role models when you're young. There is a sort of a physical and physiognomical sort of attitude to some of this research, isn't there?
You've got me. It's true. In the trailer, we do tease.
All I'm doing is just saying.
We drop a little hint that sounding gay potentially is related to how you acquire speech. And what a lot of people don't know is that women and men speak differently. And it's not just the pitch, but also other features of speech have gender. And so that's all I'm going to say. But, you know, in any language where there are genders, you will have people who quote unquote sound gay. So how's that for an answer?
I think we're giving that a big tick.
I think that was pretty good. I wanted to ask you, David, obviously we've been kind of talking about the funding model for this movie. And I just wondered about, in terms of the challenges or maybe the excitements that involves, you know, relying on engaging with the public very immediately to actually drive the project forward. Have there been any moments where you've been particularly delighted or concerned by the response of people to your funding structure and to the project? What sort of feedback do you get when people are actually engaging, when you actually get to tell them the story of what you're trying to do with this film?
Ah, the agony and the ecstasy of a Kickstarter campaign. It is a bit of a white knuckle ride to have launched such an ambitious campaign. At the same time, I think you can see from our nearly 1,000 backers that we weren't wrong in guessing that this is a film that would have wide appeal for people. The most touching, beautiful, moving, satisfying part of this Kickstarter campaign is the many men who are writing us and gay and straight, saying thank you, thank you, thank you for bringing up this subject and trying to explore it. And do I sound gay? Because I've struggled as a child, or I'm still struggling as an adult, with how people perceive me because of how I speak. And let's bear in mind, the gay voice doesn't exist. There's no one voice that every gay man has. So there are plenty of non-gay men who also kind of have to learn how to rock the stereotype, basically, and be themselves. So I have a question for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
So you are among a handful of people who've asked me if it's offensive to use the term that something sounds gay, and or that to use the term gay voice. And I just am curious if there's anxiety. I don't know if you're straight or gay or otherwise, but I'm very curious to know if non-gay people have anxiety about talking about sounding gay.
Well, it's an interesting question. I think we're both straight guys here in the studio, but actually the person who I normally present the show with is gay, and we talked before we did the show whether or not it would have been kind of nicer or fairer in some strange italicized way to ask you the questions as a gay guy and a straight guy, if you get our meaning, just because it would be nice to have, or it might seem to be more editorially equal somehow, to have a gay guy and a straight guy asking you this question, because my other colleague would have had a different experience than mine. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
But I personally, I don't have, you know, we're working pretty a very mixed office here, you know, so I don't have any problem about talking
I think it's really, really interesting. And I don't know if it's like interesting the sort of, you know, the history of it as well, and the sort of international nature of it, which I just find kind of endlessly fascinating from a kind of linguistic or, you know, point of view, if nothing else. But I just think it's incredibly interesting, and I'm happy to, you know, I would have been delighted if you'd stopped me in the street and interrogated me about it. I would have been delighted to talk to you about it.
Yeah. Well, David, it's so nice speaking to you. Thank you so much for your time. That was filmmaker David Thorpe on his documentary Do I Sound Gay, which the producers hope to release in the autumn if their crowdfunding bid is successful. Wish them every good luck with it. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you.
And there we have it, Tom. That was episode 254 of the Monocle Weekly. We had three great guests on today.
I thought it was very good guests, and I think the show was scintillating.
Should we call it Gangbusters?
I would go so far as to do that.
Baluchistan. The only part of the world named after erstwhile film star John Belushi.
Exactly. That should be the figurehead for a beautiful
on the flag.
Tourist campaign.
Big fat belly.
Very wide angle flag.
Yeah, wide angle.
A couple of flags. Might have to stitch a few together.
Have one of those sort of long, like horizontally narrow, you know what I mean? Yeah. A long thin flag. Yeah. I mean, one of those ones. That would work, wouldn't it?
Hey, I would go there. I probably wouldn't get a visa, though.
No, you might not get a visa. I really liked David Thorpe. I love that question about, do you sound gay? I think that's quite a... I know, it's a fascinating thing. It's something you hear every day, and you kind of make a value judgment on the way people sound. And you might be right or you might be wrong, but you always do it. And it's kind of interesting for him to kind of have the balls to kind of go, oh, I'm going to make a film about this.
Definitely.
And sounding like it was kind of like a very amusing... Also quite a bit of a heart-rending sort of journey.
Really interesting. I think sometimes you get these ideas that are, in their simplicity, lies the brilliance. And perhaps no one has thought that that's such a good tale to tell. And I think especially, you know, on radio, it's such a medium that's driven by the sound of a voice and the reaction of someone to a voice. Yeah, really, really great stuff. I certainly hope they realise their target. Our listeners must all support them. So
Chip
this
in.
Movie can be... visited upon the world.
Right, well, let's thank also our team behind the glass. Today's show is produced by Daphne Dinney, and our studio manager was Claire Urban. We'll probably be here same time, same place next week.
I might be, and I may be joined by our colleague Steve Bloomfield.
Oh, lovely.
So it'll be...
Stevie B and Tommy E.
It'll be a special programme.
Helming the show. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.